Without further ado, I want to give you Dr. Revel Oliver, a great statesman, a great educator, and a true crusader for freedom in America. Dr. Oliver.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here this evening. A pleasure above all to meet the congregation and the friends of the Reverend Mr. Goff. Mr. Goff was in Champaign-Urbana some months ago. He spoke in several churches there and also at a dinner we arranged, which we managed to lure some of the important political figures in the community. After that dinner, many of them said, "That was the authoritative speech on communism. Nothing has jolted me like that." I cannot hope to match that wonderful, authoritative presentation of the interior of the communist conspiracy that the Reverend Mr. Goff gave to us in Champaign-Urbana. I can merely offer you a few comments on this conspiracy as I see it from the outside. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you know, city of Chicago, along Michigan, there are some very fine taverns and bars. And a few weeks ago, it was into one of the most fashionable taverns, around 4:30 in the afternoon. There came a gentleman who, was, as was obvious from his dress and demeanor, belonged to the upper class of executives, went up to the bar, said, "Barkeep, do you have a jar, empty jar, about this high?" And the barkeep, as in a fashionable place, asked no questions. He found a jar was acceptable. The man said, "Good, now give me a martini." So the barkeep prepared the martini before the gentleman carefully lifted the olive out, put it in the jar that he had obtained, and drank the martini. "That was a good martini. Give me another." So the barkeep prepared a second martini, put it before the gentleman, who again took the olive out and deposited it in the jar, put down the martini. Well, had another one, another, then another, then another. When he got to the seventh martini, the barkeeper, remembering that this is a fashionable place as to go on its reputation, said, "Look, this is the last one for you. We don't want any alcoholics in this bar." And the gentleman, after he had removed the olive and put it in the jar and put down the martini, said, "Look, Barkeeper, I'm not an alcoholic. As a matter of fact, I don't like the stuff. But you see, just as I was leaving the office, I got a telephone call from my wife. And you know what my wife said? She said I had to, when I got home, I had to bring a jar of olives." Well, you've been kind enough to laugh at that story. And you laughed at it because it was absurd. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I submit to you that if you will take and examine almost any act of foreign policy of the United States and many acts of domestic policy, almost any act from Roosevelt's original recognition of Soviet Russia down to the recently announced masquerade in which a man named McCloy is going to run over to Europe to talk about disarmament to the Soviet, you will see that the basic explanation given to the American people for this act is a lot more absurd than the story that I have told you. It is sillier. It's more fantastic. After all, if you've got to get olives that way, you can get them by drinking martinis. But it is utterly impossible to get anything out of the Soviet Union by negotiating with it or by showing for it the slightest respect or consideration. What we have been doing is much, much more fantastic. How, then, has it been possible for an administration, a series of administrations, Roosevelt administration, Truman administration, Hoodlum Harry, as we used to call him in Washington, the Eisenhower administration, and now its successor, how has it been possible for a series of absurdities such as those to be put over on the American people? There are many reasons, but one is that the American people as a whole entertain a series of fantastic misconceptions about communism. They entertain them largely because of the information that they have derived from the distorted print in the newspapers, which too often might better be called lie sheets. The current misconceptions about communism spring, I think, from a series of small misstatements endlessly repeated over the years. Statements devised by the communist apparatus and repeated by venal politicians in a corrupt press. So much that our fellow citizens, many of them now accept them almost unconsciously, although they are all of them obviously and grotesquely wrong, if only we take a moment to think about them critically. Our fatuous and disastrous illusions about communism spring from four basic myths invented by the communists themselves. First, that it is a mass boom. Second, that it is somehow caused by poverty. Third, that it is something generically new and modern. And fourth, that it is an ideology, an economic, political, or even philosophical doctrine. All four of these notions are patently false and absurd. Let us take a moment to glance at each in turn. First, communism is not a mass movement. In Russia itself, less than 4% of the population is permitted to join the Communist Party. And 3/4 of that little minority consists of persons who can never rise above the status of clerks and disciplined servants. In the United States, it is not easy to gain admittance to even the lowest rank of the official Communist Party, which in this country, as in all countries that have not yet been taken over, includes only a small part of the effective membership. And it takes hard and unremitting work to remain a member of even the lowest rank in the Communist Party. The party is constantly purging itself of all members who are idle, inefficient, or show symptoms of moral character. It follows, therefore, that no nation has ever gone communist or turned to communism. Every nation now enslaved has been captured, as the United States will soon be captured if we do nothing about it, captured from within by a tiny minority of utterly ruthless and perfectly disciplined conspirators. That is the way in which the first conquest of international communism was effected in Russia in 1917, when 150 million people were captured under very favorable circumstances, to be sure, by 1/20 of 1% of their number. There were only 80,000 active communists in the whole Russian territory. And even this tiny gang was organized and completely controlled by a hardcore of only 1,700 expert criminals, most of whom had been trained in the United States, under the direction of a vicious degenerate named Leib Bronstein, who operated under many aliases, of which the best known is Leon Trotsky. Permit me to quote from last year's scoreboard issue of American Opinion, which I think states this point as concisely as it can be put. Communism is not a mass movement. That is the secret of its success. It has always been a tightly knit, rigidly disciplined, and numerically small conspiracy of highly talented, utterly dedicated, and totally vicious criminals. The conspiracy captures nations by boring from within, by working for years and decades to boost into positions of influence and power members who appear to outsiders to be above suspicion. It conquers by putting the right men in the right places, the places where they can subtly deceive or secretly betray. It therefore neither needs nor wants numbers. It does not enlist masses. It manipulates them. End of the quotation. You will read the very recent book by Frank S. Meyer, The Molding of the Communist. You will see how perfectly true that analysis that I have just quoted from American Opinion is. Now, second, the silliest and in the present circumstances the most dangerous of all the myths about communism is the one that is now officially used by our government as a pretext for draining away the wealth of the American people under the guise of economic aid to underdeveloped nations. A scheme which is really making the American people finance the communist conquest of the rest of the world. That is the preposterous notion that communism is somehow related to poverty. Did you ever hear of a communist who was really in poverty? For that matter, did you ever hear of a real communist who was actually a laborer or a working man? Now, communist agents, to be sure, pose as such. But almost invariably, they will, on examination, be discovered to be in the same class as the poor steel worker in Gary, Indiana, who was identified as a communist agent by the House Committee on American Activities in 1958. He had obtained employment in the steel plant under false pretenses and with a falsified record, in fact, a forged record. He was discovered to be a graduate of the University of Colorado, and as soon as he was detected and his usefulness in Gary thus terminated, he was awarded a handsome fellowship at the University of Illinois, where he is now flourishing, supported partly by the Ford Foundation, and partly by the tax-paying boons of the state of Illinois. Merely a typical example of the communist is a man who was summoned before the Senate subcommittee, where he refused to answer questions when confronted with evidence concerning his connections with the Communist Party and with 96 of its subsidiaries, affiliates, and organized operations. But he finally did admit to the committee that he owed no allegiance to the United States. This man was Marcus Isaac Goldman, B.A. Harvard, B.S. Harvard, E.M. Columbia, Ph.D. Johns Hopkins. And he had worked as a geologist in the Department of the Interior until he was retired on a pension of $382 a month. But don't think of him as a poor, starving wage slave. He was the son of a multimillionaire, and he had assets known to the committee, which made him virtually a millionaire in his own right. Or take another typical example. A person whom those of you who may have lived in Chicago some years ago may even have met. Alfred K. Stern was a multimillionaire in his own right. He married Martha Dodd, the daughter of Professor William E. Dodd, who was the American ambassador to Germany in the years immediately preceding the war that he did so much to promote. There is evidence that Miss Dodd was a communist agent while she was still living in the American embassy in Berlin. Stern's connections with communism before he married Miss Dodd are less clear, but there can be no doubt that after their marriage, both were communist agents, and that Stern, from his huge fortune, gladly contributed money to finance treason in the United States. But even to persons who knew him well, he appeared to be just a liberal, interested in such things as public housing and, of course, brotherhood. And in all probability, he would remain active and unsuspected to this day, but for a mere accident, a slip-up in the usually efficient operations of the Russian secret police. That slight slip, plus the nervousness of the Sterns, led to their exposure. In July 1957, they fled to Russia, perhaps unnecessarily. For had they chosen to brazen it out in the United States, it is unlikely that they would have been convicted on the relatively small amount of evidence that was really available against them. And even if they had been convicted, it's a safe bet, I think, that the Warren gang in the Supreme Court would have found some way to turn them loose. There's another side to this picture that you should also consider. The International Communist Conspiracy is by far the wealthiest organization in the world, and it has literally unlimited funds at its disposal. Where necessary, it buys what it needs, from small retail stores to great newspapers and radio stations. And where necessary, it hires traitors and pays them well. For example, the titular head of a very minor communist front in West Germany, the Westdeutscher Flüchtlingskongress, is paid a salary of $2,000 a month. Now, this Flüchtlingskongress, a relatively small communist front, and the employee that we have mentioned takes no risk, because the Flüchtlingskongress professes a humanitarian purpose, and although observers in Germany are as morally certain of its nature as we are about the hundreds of organizations in this country that ostensibly work for mental health or international understanding or brotherhood, the German police have been able to find no documentary proof of its communist direction. There's just the $2,000 a month that comes in from mysterious sources. By the way, communist employees in Germany are paid, if they wish, in bar gold, which, if they want to, they can sell on the black market and make an additional profit. Or if they want to, they can put it away in their sock for the rainy day that is coming and capitalism disappears. Is that poverty and communism? Nonsense! Communism is a conspiracy of the well-educated and the wealthy. You have only to examine the record see that that is true. Now, third, the professed goals of communism, equality, a classless society, socialism, are sold to the ignorant, and particularly to those extremely ignorant people who call themselves liberal intellectuals, as somehow new and progressive ideas. Whereas they are in reality, as every student of history and anthropology well knows, the oldest errors of mankind. Marxian socialism is merely a regression to barbarism and savagery. The only classless societies that have ever existed on this earth were found among the lowest and most stupid savages. For example, the Aborigines of Australia, whose mental capacity I will leave you to judge for yourselves, from the fact that they propagated themselves on that continent for at least 60,000 years without once suspecting that there might be a causal connection between sexual intercourse and pregnancy. No wonder they got a classless society. The concept of private property is the mark of civilization. It is unknown among savages. The individual savage really owns nothing, although he may possess a few beads for adornment or a spear. But so far as there is anything that may be called property, it belongs to the tribe. To the rudimentary mind of human animals, the very notion of private ownership of real property is abhorrent and unjust. And that, by the way, is a point that you must bear in mind when you consider the grotesque survivals of the Stone Age that the communist conspiracy is now introducing in the guise of independent nations into one of its favorite instrumentalities, that obscene vaudeville show in New York City called the United Nations. The savages of Africa, many of them, as you know, are enthusiastic cannibals, are necessarily on the side of the communists because the Marxian doctrine merely expresses what seems obvious to their dim consciousness. Socialism, since it requires an elaborate organization, is found in practice only in the stage next above pure savagery, barbarism. The socialist state and economic planning first appear in history in the barbarous monarchies of the early Orient, of which you will find an illuminating, if somewhat complex, analysis in Karl A. Wittvogel's Oriental Despotism. But the most complete example of a socialist state known to history was found in Peru, among the people whom we incorrectly call the Incas. Inca, as you know, title of the king, the ruler, not really obvious. This stupid and bovine race had no system of coinage or commerce, no writing or literature, no capacity for reflective thought, and so far as we can tell, gave no promise of ever being able to attain these fundamentals of a higher culture. But they did have a well-developed agriculture, some skill in the construction of permanent buildings, and a system of bookkeeping. Bookkeeping, as you know, by coded threads, equivalent, no writing. All land was communal. All production was organized for use instead of profit. And the whole economy was planned by an elaborate bureaucracy which had 1,331 administrators for every 10,000 persons. Thus, you see, a little more advanced than the government of Washington. The human livestock lived and died as domestic animals on a vast plantation. And, like sheep or cows, they had so little individualism and intelligence that they were quite happy in such an existence. Peru, before the Spaniards came, was really a socialist paradise. It is true that socialism as a form of economic organization also appears in history at the other end of the scale, as the clearest manifestation of the decadence of a dying state. But it never reaches the perfection that it attained among the Indians of Peru, for the simple reason that the nation dies before the cancerous growth has reached its theoretical maximum. The decline of the Roman Empire may be measured almost automatically by the growth of its bureaucracy. Of this cancer, the Roman world died slowly in an agony that extended over at least two centuries. And the result was, of course, the reversion to barbarism that we properly call the Dark Ages. even in the most highly developed cultures, such as those of Greece and Rome, and of the Western world since the Renaissance, civilization and rationality have at best but a precarious control over the residual barbarism latent in mankind. The history of the Occidental world is maculated by innumerable sects or gangs of ignorant fanatics who preached under one guise or another a return to the joyous barbarism in which all men were equal, all property was held in common for the use of all, and all of society was planned and managed by self-appointed experts who claimed to possess oversized brains or oversized souls or both. In antiquity, you will find, even in the high part of classical civilization, some odd Stoic sects, such as the one headed by Blasius of Cumae. There are many others. If you're interested in following it up, the most concise account is in a book that unfortunately has not been translated into English, Robert von Pohlmann's Geschichte der sozialen Frage. Eric Vogelein, in the volumes thus far published of his Order in History, considers the development, or rather the recrudescence, the reappearance of socialistic concepts from time to time from antiquity into the Middle Ages. You can trace this kind of barbaric desire to return to the primitive through the 18th century, until you come to the anti-religious conspiracy of the Perfectibilisten, commonly called the Illuminati, organized by Adam Weishaupt, and you come to the bloodthirsty Jacobins of France. Ladies and gentlemen, there is nothing new about the so-called doctrines of Marxism. They come from the primeval abyss of ignorance and savagery that is much, much older recorded or recoverable history. What is new is the size and perfect organization of the worldwide conspiracy that is using these old barbaric yachts for its own purposes. Now, fourth, to think of communism as an ideology that can be combated and destroyed by argument and reason, or by kindness and tolerance, is as foolish is trying to tame a rattlesnake by patting its head. To be sure, we can and we must present the simple and obvious facts. The multitude of sentimental, vain, greedy, or somnolent persons whom the disguised communists manipulate through the hundreds of seemingly humanitarian organizations that they have created for that purpose. By presenting the facts to anyone not completely immune to reason, we can accomplish a great deal. Provided, of course, that these people are not immune to reason, that they have not been too thoroughly brainwashed in our modern schools. But you simply waste your time if you try to talk to a real hardcore communist. There is simply nothing to talk about. There is nothing to talk about for two distinct and conclusive reasons. The first, intellectual, and the second, emotional. Argument presupposes an attempt to ascertain truth. But for the communist, truth does not exist. He is a pragmatist who follows the doctrines of John Dewey to their logical and ultimate consequences. For him, words are weapons to be used to attain his end. A drug to poison and paralyze his victims. He is the result of a long and intensive training within the Communist Party, a training too complex for me to attempt to analyze it within the compass of the little time that we have here. One of the best analyses that I know is by my friend Frank Meyer, a former communist organizer, in his recently published book, The Molding of the Communist. Mr. Meyer knows whereof he speaks. If you read that book, you will be simply astonished by the efficacy of the communist training, and above all by the fact that people willingly undergo it. It's almost impossible to believe that human beings with any self-respect at all would lend themselves to training that is designed to drive from the party anyone who is not completely, utterly its instrument. For Myers says, the communist becomes a mere extension, a living extension of the party, lacking all individuality in himself. But consider this case. I don't have time for it, I think. One of the people who Mr. Meyer knew was a young woman teacher in a university. She was a professional psychologist teaching in a large and important university. She was also a member of the Communist Party, and as such, she had charge of a small group. This was during the communist attempt to take over Spain in 1936. The party sent her on a mission to Spain, and she accomplished it brilliantly at considerable risk to her life. Her life was in danger at least four times while she was doing this work in Spain. She was completely successful, and she came back to the United States and to the communist cell, which she was a member. What would you expect? Surely she deserved some praise, didn't she? Surely she deserved some recognition of an accomplishment that had taken remarkable courage in a woman. We don't expect women to risk their lives. And great sagacity. Instead, she got a severe rebuke because the records of her section had not been kept up while she was gone. And she finally had to confess publicly to the party that she was in error and that it was her fault that these records, and she had no assistant, mind you, who could have done them in her absence, that these records had not been kept up while she was in Spain. So fantastic. Utterly impossible. To make such a confession, she must have become irrational. It'd be like confessing your responsibility because somebody stumbled on the street in London. Right now, it's irrational. But that is part of this intensive brainwashing process. To give you that as an example, as I say, go on to analyze its further development. Would require, in fact, hours to do the subject justice. But the final result is that the communist thinks, as Mr. Meyer puts it, that there is only one answer to any question on any subject. Question, should I get married? Should I divorce my wife? Does the blood circulate in the human body? What is the distance of Betelgeuse from the solar system? What was the date of the fall of the Sumerian Empire? Any and every question that can be asked by a human being has, in the communist mind, one correct answer. And that is the answer that will, at the moment, serve the purposes of the communist conspiracy. The answer may be different tomorrow, of course, when the objective situation, as they call it, has changed. Communists have got to be able to denounce today the very doctrine that he was most enthusiastically advocating yesterday. He's got to do it without the slightest feeling of shame, without the slightest feeling of inconsistency. It isn't inconsistent to his mind. What he's doing is telling these folks what they ought to think right now, so that communism may eventually triumph. In other words, it's a complete repudiation of the whole concept of truth, and therefore a complete repudiation of the basis of human reason. If there is no truth, there can be no reason, but there's nothing to reason about. But this intellectual nihilism, I think, serves a fixed and terrible emotion. Although the mind of the true and seasoned communist operates with a ruthless lucidity and with appalling ingenuity, it is driven, I think, by a furious passion that is an inverted religion, a passion that seeks evil for its own sake. If you wish to use Christian terms, it is Satanism. And the communists among us are the modern counterparts of the thousands and thousands of people who in the Middle Ages secretly worshipped Satan with abominable rites, primarily because they hated with a deep, instinctive, and unappeasable hatred everything that Christianity calls good. The communist is driven by an insatiable hatred of Western civilization and of everything that we esteem. Truth, honor, decency, mercy, integrity, learning, culture. He is driven by an overwhelming lust to defile and destroy, to desecrate and maim, to torture and to kill. For an analysis of this monstrous mentality, you will find very instructive Denis de Rougemont's recent work, Man's Western Quest. For a proof of it, you have only to inspect the record of what has happened in every country that the communist conspiracy has captured. The uniformly sickening record of the torture and murder of millions of human beings with no intelligible purpose other than a frenzied sadism and a lust to reduce men to the level of beasts. It is murder for the sake of murder, torture for the joy of torturing. And if you expect the rabid beasts who now direct the communist conspiracy to behave in the United States if they take it over in any way different from that in which they have uniformly and consistently behaved in the half of the world they have already taken over, God help you, for you will believe anything. The communist conspiracy operates with an almost infinite versatility. And it is extremely difficult sometimes to identify it without some practice in observing it in its many, many manifestations. It operates with an infinite versatility. Like syphilis, it adapts itself to every vital organ in the whole organism that it is attacking. It can masquerade under the guise of any force that is useful to it to weaken or to attack the moral, religious, and racial structure of the society that it undertakes to subvert. It masquerades in the guise of all religions and preys on the credulity of all races. In absolute monarchies, it cozens the king. As you know, communists have taken over. With the active cooperation of the king, absolute monarchies such as Morocco, Yemen, and absolute monarchies, they make the king think that he is going to get what he wants. In democracies, it cozens blocks of voters, offering them some bribe to their pocketbook or some bribe to their emotions. It always calculates nicely the cupidity and the fatuity of its victims. It preaches nationalism, independence, and self-determination to the blacks of Africa. And it preaches internationalism, interdependence, and one world to the suckers in the United States. It is all things to all men according to their folly. It is as versatile as evil itself. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the real secret of the conspiracy's success. Consider what it has accomplished in this country in less than a century. At the time that the headquarters of the Communist International were openly and officially transferred to New York City in 1872, the conspiracy went entirely underground. I'm sorry, in 1872, there were only a few hundred people in the United States who were willing to become members of the conspiracy. It was in 1876 that the conspiracy went entirely underground. And its members were instructed to devote themselves to infiltrating and capturing existing American educational, religious, and social organizations. It was not until 1907 that the conspiracy felt itself strong enough to set on foot two complementary groups, a public terrorist group and the first communist front that can be identified with real certainty. The terrorist gang was organized under the name IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, and it was headed by William Z. Foster, a criminal who was at that time or soon thereafter the close associate to Felix Frankfurter, who is now a justice in our Supreme Court. The Communist Front was called the Methodist Federation for Social Service, and was founded by Dr. Harry F. Ward, a Methodist minister in Evanston, Illinois, who later became a professor in the Union Theological Seminary. An ordained criminal whose membership in the Communist Party has been established beyond all possible doubt by the sworn testimony of many witnesses. The present official Communist Party, of the Communist Party of the United States, it is called, was not organized until 1919, headed again, of course, by our old friend William Z. Foster. What it has accomplished since that time, generally 1919 is the point at which most histories of communism in the United States begin, although the very significant antecedents to which I have very briefly alluded are, I think, necessary for a full understanding of the way in which it works. What they've accomplished since 1919 is obvious. Small party, yes. But have they ever been defeated in their incessant attacks on the United States of America? Oh. Slight, very slight inconvenience from time to time. Senator McCarthy annoyed them a little for a while. Martin Dies did. Yes, they've been annoyed a little, but they have moved steadily forward through all of those years, constantly gathering strength in this country in their ability to dictate to the American government, and using that strength to advance communism throughout the world by adjusting American foreign policy to the requirements of a communist conspiracy abroad. The party was organized in 1919, but I think a somewhat more significant date is 1918. Within that year, according to Mr. Whitney and his authoritative Reds in America, published a few years after the event, that a Boston school teacher identified, you'll find her name in Mr. Whitney's book, publicly stated, "Give us one generation of American children to train, and we shall have the United States a part of the communist world." 1918. Well, first they didn't get the one generation right off in 1918, but figure out what time they have had since. you'll observe that their influence in the educational system has constantly increased, and that their brainwashed victims have constantly increased in number. That's what we call the great advance of education in this country. You have only to consider, pick almost at random, any aspect of American relations with the communist conspiracy. Just pick any subject, domestic or foreign, in which the interests of the United States and of the communist conspiracy are both involved. Believe me, that's almost any subject. And simply ask, oh, for example, you hear a lot of yammering about the horrors of atomic warfare. Ain't it awful? Soviets got the atomic bomb and they got the hydrogen bomb. And nobody stops to ask how they got it. They got it by stealing, by taking the work of the Manhattan Project, as it was called in this country, transmitting American results to the Soviet Union. What is more, Edward Evans, in his excellent book, The Secret War for the A-Bomb, thinks it extremely probable that the first atomic bombs exploded by the Russians were manufactured in the United States and exported part by part to them. They got it in other ways. Always with American help. What is the principal substance that you need for the manufacture of nuclear weapons? Obviously, radioactive materials, and above all, uranium. Where is the principal source of uranium in the Soviet, in the whole Soviet territory? They'll get some from the Congo, which we recently saw to it. They were taking over, and the uranium deposits of the Congo are not really being exploited yet. Their real source of uranium now are the great uranium mines just south of the German border in Czechoslovakia. You might might glance at the recently published book by Professor Kurt Glosser, A Critical History of Czechoslovakia. Fairly well on in the book, you will see an account of how it happens that those uranium mines are in Soviet possession. The American armies under General Patton had penetrated into Czechoslovakia until they were practically to Prague. Officers in General Patton's army got jeeps and drove into Prague and drove back. We don't know, we can't say exactly how many miles that was, because the records are still kept secret and classified, and the only man who could have spoken and would have spoken, General Patton, died not long thereafter in what was called an accident. But the American armies were ordered to retreat so that the Russians could occupy Czechoslovakia, and they were specifically ordered to evacuate the areas in which these uranium mines are. And you know, it's just impossible to believe that American intelligence did not know that those uranium mines were there. And further, that American intelligence did not know that Eduard Beneš, the premier of Czechoslovakia, had leased those mines in perpetuity to the Soviet Union in 1943, long before the end of the war. All right, that's where they're getting the uranium. The largest of the uranium mines is operated by a crew of 30,000 slaves, which forms the largest of the 250 slave labor camps now in Czechoslovakia. Country is important also because it is the industrial heart of the communist empire. It's the Pittsburgh of communist territory. All right, that's how they got nuclear weapons. They also got the German scientists who had developed guided missiles long before the end of the war. And they got those by specific acts of the American Army acting under orders. But we hear all of this yammering about, oh, ain't it awful now they've got the atomic bomb. We mustn't ask how they got it, because that's to ask about the past. But now we've got to make sure that there isn't an atomic holocaust, because that would be just horrible.
I might get hurt.
Well, I don't know. All this, but I don't understand this propaganda about atomic warfare. It seems to be assumed that the atomic bomb somehow makes people deader than they would be if they had their brains beaten out with a club. I assure you, there is no scientific evidence that people are any deader when they are killed with atomic bomb. But there is a great deal of incontrovertible proof that if you ever have to choose between death in an atomic bombardment and life under the rule of the Bolsheviks, you will be very, very foolish if you do not choose the quick and clean end. But ostensibly, in obedience to the yammering fools and cowards and communist agents, the United States has halted, as you know, the testing of nuclear weapons. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what conceivable purpose can a halt in the testing of nuclear weapons serve? Can you imagine any purpose that it might serve other than that of giving the Soviet time to catch up with us? Or, and this is an interesting alternative, providing for a period in which we have suspended work, the Soviet undoubtedly is going on working, so that in a year or 2 years from now, we can be told that the Soviet has developed some super duper ultra hydrogen bomb that is just so terrible that war is at last unthinkable. Meantime, just notice the history of this. For example, occasionally our government sees fit to say that, oh, we're superior, we have anything to worry about. And that's generally the story on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Wednesdays and Fridays, why, we're told that the Russians are way ahead of us and they've got much better missiles than we have. That story is based almost entirely on the so-called Sputniks, moon rocket, and so on. They're largely hoaxes. The moon rocket certainly was. They not only managed to send the rocket to the moon, but they made it invisible and undetectable while it was going. That's real science. But notice, recently General Medeiros published a book, Countdown for Decision. In this book, he discloses the very significant fact that the United States would have launched an artificial satellite a full year before the first Russian Sputnik, had not he, General Medeiros, been specifically ordered to prevent a test missile from going into orbit. In other words, someone in the United States government with authority over General Medeiros deliberately and consciously gave to the Soviets the opportunity for the great triumph in terms of prestige and propaganda that they achieved 1 year later, quite possibly by using plans stolen in the United States, and possibly even using instruments manufactured in the United States. Lloyd Mellon, whose very interesting little book, Russia and the Big Red Lie, is a very, very significant report on the present state of Russian technology. Reports that all of their good instruments are either imported from the United States or are careful copies. Copies sometimes carried out even to the absurd point of reproducing the trademark of instruments that they have imported from the United States. Another aspect of our military program, Major Alexander de Seversky has recently published a book entitled America, Too Young to Die. I'm not going to attempt to give you a resume of it. It has one serious defect. Major de Seversky accepts Russian claims at their face value. He isn't skeptical about this wonderful device that somehow got to the moon without being seen, heard, or otherwise observed. But he does give you absolute and positive evidence that the development of American armaments from the B-52 plane on to the most advanced type of rockets and defense against rockets has been systematically frustrated by government order. I have to read his book for the details. As I say, he overestimates Russian achievements, so I think he is a little too emphatic when he says that by 1962, Russia will be able to inflict greater damage on us than we can inflict on her. My own guess is maybe it ought to be 65 or 68. But he is essentially right. Not long ago, I had the privilege of hearing, and before a select and closed group, General Bonner Fellers give an analysis of the present status of our Air Force. General Fellers pointed out, for example, that our B-52s are wearing out and that they are not being replaced. That within a few years, we will have just junk left. I verified that from two officers now on duty in the Air Force and from a man who had recently returned as chief maintenance officer of one of our important air bases overseas. I have simply chosen this matter of weapons. Take anything else. Take Burma. That bizarre country is drifting gradually into the communist orbit. We are pushing. For details, I'll refer you to the scoreboard issue entitled A World Gone Crazy of American Opinion last year. But did you notice that a couple of months ago, the only real obstacle to the communists in Burma, which was the Chinese who escaped into North Burma when the United States betrayed General Chiang Kai-shek and set up the communist regime of Mao Zedong in China. These Chinese have remained over the years loyal to Chiang Kai-shek. And since many of them were nationalist soldiers, even after all these years, they knew how to fight the communists whenever the latter appeared. There were only 15,000 of them at most. Some observers say there were only 12,000. I myself think that's perhaps the better figure. But Mao Zedong had to send four divisions of his army to wipe them out. Although these loyal Chinese in North Burma were getting some supplies from Formosa by air, there is no telling how long they might have held out in the jungle, even when so outnumbered. The communists evidently were worried, for the American Department of State had to intervene once again. Typical work. It issued peremptory and insulting orders to General Chiang Kai-shek to desist immediately from sending further supplies to the anti-communist Chinese in Burma to avoid provocation. The State Department issued those orders, and incidentally, so far as I know, no newspaper and no weekly news magazine thought it worthwhile to let its readers in on the sequel. Look, we could go on for hours, ladies and gentlemen. Korea, Cuba, any part of the world to which you turn. Take the present situation in Peru. Take the present situation in Argentina. Take the present situation in Mexico. Everywhere, if you will examine the record, you will see a series of constant interventions by the Department of State, supposedly part of the American government. Interventions which have uniformly resulted in the strengthening and advance of the communist conspiracy. I urge you to go pick out any one of these things and look at it for yourselves. Because if you will examine just one of these incidents, Korea or Cuba, hear about Cuba Sunday night, I think. But look up the data for yourselves. And that will tell you much more, be much more convincing to you than anything I or 100 speakers could possibly tell you. Just ask yourselves what conceivable motivation could human beings, intelligent enough, you know, to learn the difference between the accelerator and the brake pedal on an automobile, what conceivable motive could they have had in going through the series of events, of acts and the policies that have resulted in the constant advance of the communist conspiracy throughout the world? Examine that and then draw your own conclusions. Ladies and gentlemen, if you can't draw conclusions from that evidence, God help you.